Good evening, everyone. Welcome. Thank you for joining us for the Haggadah night. Just to explain what's going to go on, pretty simple, nothing so unique. What's going to happen is that each of the four members of the Kollel, Rabbi Turchiner, will begin. Yisrael Meir Rosenzweig will go after him. Rabbi David Eli Grunland will follow, and then I will conclude. And each member will have about 10-15 minutes to share one, maybe perhaps one or two ideas related to the Haggadah. The hope is, by the end of the night, to have perhaps a few different perspectives, new ideas, questions, answers to different issues, different parts related to the Haggadah and the Seder night.
Thank you, Rabbi. Good evening to everyone. I wanted to talk about an issue that comes up pretty much every year at the Seder that has kind of bothered me personally in terms of understanding why exactly it is an issue in the first place. And that is the topic of chatzos, the idea that there are certain mitzvos that we need to perform at the Seder by halachic midnight. For example, we'll see in just a moment, the afikomen needs to be eaten, be consumed by halachic midnight. So there have been situations, I'm sure maybe others have experienced, where you're at a Seder and everything's going well, dessert's taking a little too long, and people all of a sudden are rushed, because we know we need to get to the afikomen, and the clock is ticking and ticking and ticking. It's a strange idea, especially when you look in the Haggadah itself, the very beginning, when at the paragraph of Avadim Hayinu, the end of that paragraph, it says, "Kol amarve l'saper v'yetzias Mitzrayim, hari zeh meshubach." It's praiseworthy to keep going and going. And we hear the story of the Chachamim in Bnei Brak, who went on until Alas Shachar. They went until dawn broke. Nothing about Chatzos there. And yet, we rush to finish in time to make Chatzos. So what is the distinction there that's being drawn? So initially, I thought maybe there is a difference between telling the story, meaning speaking, versus eating. An action of eating the matzah. That's nice, it kind of works, but it still bothers me because why am I eating the afikomen? It's part of the story. It's also telling the story. So therefore, I would think maybe it should follow those same rules. It should also, everything should be done by chatzos. Or that, or maybe we should just go all night, but we see that there's a difference. So I want to focus on that idea of chatzos. In discussing the afikomen, the Shulchan Aruch states the following. After you finish your Suda, you take matzah from under the tablecloth, or cloth, as it were, in our case, and you eat a kezayis. Each person eats a kezayis, and that's the afikomen. And why are we eating that? Zecher lepesach ha-nechal al-soba. And that is eaten in remembrance of the carbon pesach, which was eaten on a full stomach. That's why we eat it after the meal. And you eat it leaning over, and you do not say a bracha. And then at the very end here, he says, "Vihei zahir la'achlo kodem chatzos." Be very careful to eat it before chatzos. Doesn't necessarily give a reason. But we know with the Karban Pesach itself, there's a dispute. Everyone agrees that it needs to be eaten by chatzos. There's a dispute. Is that from the Torah, or is that a rabbinic decree? If it's from the Torah, then it's learned through a connection between two psukim. On one hand, we have the idea that on the night of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Malach HaMavis went through Egypt and killed all the firstborns. And that happened at Chatzos, at midnight. And we were told, you know, you put the blood on the doorposts, and you had until Chatzos, seemingly, to perform that act. And it says, this is happening, B'layla Hazeh, that is occurring on this night. And in a separate pasuk, it describes the Karban Pesach, and it says, you will eat the meat, B'layla Hazeh, on this night. So it's the same wording. So if one is until chatzos, therefore the other is until chatzos. That, again, that works also. If we're eating the afikomen in remembrance of the carbon pesach, which had to be completed by chatzos, it should follow those same rules. But that, you know, that works, and it's a nice, I don't want to say dry, but a dry halachic answer, and it's nice and crisp. It works. If we turn our attention back to that Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, continues and adds on another detail, that you also need to read Hallel before Chatzos. So then, that also maybe could tie into that initial understanding that I just explained. With the Karban Pesach, we also said Hallel when we ate the Karban Pesach. And so therefore, it also fits into that. It's in remembrance of the Karban Pesach. We're going to throw a wrench into that right now. With the Vilna Gaon and his comments on that Rama, he says, why are we pushing ourselves to read Hallel before Chatzos? Bishvil Kos Dalet, for the sake of the fourth kos. So now all of a sudden we need to drink the fourth kos before Chatzos. And that, to me, doesn't follow. Because the Akikomen and Hallel, fine, those connect very clearly to the Karban Pesach and what we used to do in the Beis HaMikdash. But the Dalet Kosos, that doesn't have quite the same clear connection to the Karban itself. So in order to understand that, I want to take a step back and look at the four kosos and what they represent. And to do that, I want to look at two statements from Rabbi Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, also known as the Mesher Chochma or the Or Sameach, as per his great works that he wrote. And in the beginning of Parshas Bo, he comments on the four kosos and he invokes a classic Yerushalmi that perhaps many of us have heard, that the four kosos correspond to the four terms of redemption, the four languages of redemption, which are, I will take you out, I will save you, I will redeem you, and I will take you to me to be a nation. Hashem speaking to Klal Yisrael. And he goes through and he explains how each of those correspond, how they correspond clearly to the four kosos. For example, the first one, Behotzeisi, I will take you out, is Kiddush. And why is he making that connection? Because in order to have been taken out of Eretz Mitzrayim, we had to make it possible. We ourselves, through our actions, had to make it possible for Hashem to do that. And so he suggests perhaps it was because we withheld ourselves from any immoral relationships with the Mitzrayim, with the Egyptians. We didn't involve ourselves with their family life. And so just as tearing apart a family would not be possible, if we had involved ourselves with them in terms of immoral relations, it would have been impossible to take us out. The fact that we did not do that made it possible to take us out. So therefore, that fits in with Kiddush, because that's Kedusha and being Mekadesh, being sanctifying this world. And then he goes on, the next language of redemption was, I will save you, which he actually skips to the third kos, the kos that we use for benching, for Birchas HaMazon. And explains that there's an idea that's brought out in the Midrash that Bnei Yisrael did not inform on one another to the Egyptian government. And that informing on somebody would imply a lack of faith on your part. You think you have to take things into your hand, that Hashem is not going to take care of things. So the fact that we did not do that demonstrates our tremendous faith. And that fits in with Birchas HaMazon, which itself is an act of faith and describes how Hashem takes care of this world and everything, from the biggest animals to the smallest, tiniest little organisms. And then he continues on with he goes back to the second kos. And Vigalti, I will redeem you. And he describes how slavery dehumanizes people. You no longer have any connection to your past. That was not true of Bnei Yisrael, though. We did maintain that connection by maintaining our names, as the Midrash describes, that he's linking in with. And that, he says, refers to the first part of Hallel that we read before eating the meal. Because that part of Hallel describes our ancestors, meaning to say that we are still connected with our past. And then the final one, L'chachti, I will take you to me to be a nation, is referring to the fact that they did not abandon their native tongue, their language in Mitzrayim, and that was born out of their staunch hope and dream for the future. I'm not abandoning my language because I know and I hope that in the future I will be using it again in freedom. And so that's how he frames the four kosos, that they're really merits that we had in Egypt in the past, but also that they're prospective. They go forward, they're looking forward. And so it creates its image almost of the entirety of Jewish history, where you have the past, present, and future being embodied and symbolized by the Dalet Kosos. So that's nice. That's what we're drinking to, in a sense. That doesn't help us with Chatzos, seemingly. So we have to turn to another idea. With the Karban Pesach itself, there were two commands given to us. I mean, there were many commands regarding the Karban given to us, but two in particular that I want to look at. The first is, Al tachlu mimenu na uvashal mavushal. Do not eat from it partially roasted, basically raw or cooked in water. Rather, it needs to be roasted completely on fire. And then in the very next pasuk, the Torah says, V'lo totiru mimenu ad boker. Do not leave any over. It needs to be eaten completely that night. There are two words that are very interesting. The first pasuk began with all, and the second one with lo. So what's the difference? If I were translated in English, there is literally no difference. It's don't do this and don't do that. But in Hebrew, there's a very big difference, as Rabbi Meir Simcha of Divinsk will describe. He says all is a language of a bakasha, of a request. Don't do this, please. And he goes through a large list of sources to try and prove this across Tanakh and out of the Gemara. And then he says, lo is a much more absolute command. Do not do that. There's no please there. There's no request to it. And so why should there be that difference? I think the first one occurred before nightfall. You're preparing the korban. It was before Makas Bechoros. It was before Yetzias Mitzrayim had really started. Whereas the leaving over, that occurred after Chatzos. So something very important happened at Chatzos that caused a shift from a request to an absolute command. And so he tells us, Malchus Bechoros was essentially a revelation of Hashem's presence in this world, and that he had control over everything, and that he was taking us. He broke those chains that we had been chained to Mitzrayim with, and took us to him. And in his original language, he says the following, Azdavu kinyan ha'eluki ba'am Yisrael. At that point, God's acquisition, in his words, of Am Yisrael took place. Essentially, we were bound to him. The relationship began. It was really solidified at that point. It was almost like tying the knot, as it were. And he even goes so far as to say that the chiyuv of our requirement to fulfill all the mitzvos is dependent on this moment in time. It's very interesting because what happened to Har Sinai there, so that requires some exploration. But I thought perhaps that is what that is why we want to finish the Arbakosos before Chatzos. Because they are representative of everything that occurred in the time. They are representative of our future, of the entirety of Jewish history. Meaning to say, the role that we are carving out in the world as individuals and as a community. And so we want to do that at Chatzos in remembrance of that relationship that was forged at that moment in time. And I would suggest that perhaps at Chatzos and our Seders, when perhaps, hopefully, we've finished off coming before that in the Dalitosis and Hallel, etc., even if we haven't, if we missed the mark, at that point, to still think to ourselves, who am I as an individual in terms of a relationship with Hashem? Because at that point in time, we're saying that's when the relationship really began, was really forged and tied. Who am I as an individual in terms of that relationship? And who am I as a member of the Jewish people in terms of the relationship that we entered into together at that point? I wish everyone a beautiful Pesach. Thank you.
So I'm going to speak about the order of the Pesach Seder, right? We all know, we start off with the song, Kadeh Shurchas, right? We all know the song, we all do it. So a few years back, I was outside the Rami Levi in Gush Etzion, and outside Rami Levi before Pesach, they have a huge table there with more Haggadot than you've ever seen in your life. And I happened to walk by one, and I opened it. It was called the Hasidic Haggadah.
Okay,
I opened to the first page, and it says in the name of a Rebbe that I've never heard of before. I couldn't even tell you from where. And it must have been a modern Rebbe, because it says in his name, he loves Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because when you walk down the street and you ask people in Eretz Yisrael, how are you? They say, Hakol Beseder. And he says, they don't know how right they are. Everything that happens to us all year round is all because of what happened at the Pesach Seder. So I started thinking about this. how much of the Seder really reflects onto our lives. And it seems that the Seder can really be used as an archetype for our lives and for how to approach life. And really, I mean, my first Pesach Seder in Eretz Yisrael was actually at the house of Rabbi David Zeller, Zichron Ali Bracha. He was the son of two Jungian psychoanalysts, and their whole chevra, all their friends, were also Jungian psychoanalysts. So their Pesach Seder was always just understood as an archetype for the transition within an individual moving from slavery to freedom. And that not only is it a general transition, within that night itself, within the Pesach Seder, we are taking ourselves from a place of slavery and we are bringing ourselves into a place of freedom. This same idea is found within a lot of Hasidic work. One place specifically is the Avodat Yisrael, the by the Koshnitz Ramagid, which I'll get to in a second. Interestingly enough, something I noticed yesterday, that if we're talking about the Seder on a psychological level, that how many parts of the Seder are there? Does anyone know? Offhand? There are 15 parts of the Seder, assuming Motzi and Matzah are separate. Some Haggadot keep them together, so there's only 14. Assuming they are separate, there are 15 parts to the Seder. Interestingly enough, I discovered yesterday, there are also 15 parts to the human brain. I have them listed here if you'd like, but I don't think anyone's going to remember, so it's okay. There are 15 parts to the human brain, so I'm not going to go through this now, but I thought about it as a nice project for the future, maybe trying to correlate one-to-one the parts of the Pesach Seder to the parts of the brain and how they function. But that's an exercise for another day. When we look at Yitzhak Mitzrayim, we see a physical redemption happen to Am Yisrael. But it's very clear from the Chumash that we didn't achieve psychological redemption. But that was still left. Right? We see we went through 40 years in the Midbar, and it had to be 40 years because the people weren't psychologically ready to move on. And, you know, we see that with modern Mitzrayims that Am Yisrael has experienced, that people have a very hard time moving on. Decades later, people are trapped in what things they went through, and they have a hard time moving on. And part of the exercise with Pesach Seder is really trying to guide us along this process of freeing ourselves and learning how to experience Yitziat Mitzrayim for ourselves. As we all know, the Haggadah says, "Behold, dor v'dor chayav adam li'arot et atzmok ilu yitziat Mitzrayim." We all need to see ourselves as though we are coming out of Egypt. So I'm going to try to give some ideas as far as how to do this. Ideally, I would go through all the various segments of the Seder, but there's time is not going to allow for it. So I'm going to extract a few ideas. So the first thing is, when we look around this room even, what do we see? We see people. A lot of individual people. So the Eben Shlomo says in the name of the Koshnitzer Magid, Rabbi Yisrael Hofstein, that the whole idea of Yitziat Mitzrayim is about recognizing that everyone is created B'Tzelem Elokim. Everyone is created in the divine image. For the most part, unfortunately, we don't even see that in ourselves. Right? We see ourselves in our struggles and our challenges and our flaws, and we don't recognize that I am in the divine image. And so the Koshnitzer Magid says the whole idea of Yitziat Mitzrayim is to free ourselves from everything that holds us back and to really start recognizing that we are B'Tzelem Elokim. And he says the first part that we see this is in the Yachatz. Yachatz is the breaking of the middle matzah. As an aside, we're talking about the order of the Seder. Yachatz is totally out of order. When do we normally break bread? After Motzi. This is at the beginning, before Magi. This is really before anything has happened. We're already breaking bread, even though there's no bracha. And so he says that this idea that we don't see ourselves in Tzelem Elokim, he says this is because we're all a little bit broken inside. Right? He says there's an element of brokenness in all of us, and the way we fix this is when we break the middle matzah. And he gives a kind of meditation to do. He says when we break the middle matzah, we should hear it breaking. Right? We should take a moment and, you know, close your eyes And as you're breaking the middle matzah, you should hear it breaking. And he says you should hear the brokenness of the world. You should hear the world breaking. And he says you should break your own heart as you break the matzah. As we know, there's a pasuk, lev mishbar v'nidche elokim lo tivazeh. A broken and rejected heart will not be discarded by Hashem. And he says, similarly, as we break the matzah, we have to recognize our brokenness and recognize that we are now on a journey to free ourselves from that brokenness and to see the divine image. And we go straight from that into the Magid. As Rabbi Torchino mentioned earlier, the Magid starts off with Halach Ma'anya. And part of Halach Ma'anya is Kol Dichvin Yeteh Ve'echol, Kol Ditzrich Yeteh Ve'yisach. Anyone who is hungry, come and eat. Anyone who is in need, please come and share the Pesach with us. And he says, this is all about the same thing. This is all about seeing the divine image. Because normally, when we invite people to our table, you say, everyone's welcome to come to my Pesach Seder, but please first shower and put on your best clothes. Right? We only want people who are at shul, and we want people who are clean and together and well-kept. He says, but that's missing the point. We're talking about everyone. Kol ditzrich yeteh v'yisach. Everyone who's in need. Everyone who's hungry. Come. And he's saying that the problem is, when, for the most part, we look around the world, and we look around the room, and we see people, and we see the way they look on the outside, and we see all the externalities. And he says, that's the Mitzrayim. That's what we're stuck in seeing, and we have to try to get ourselves to a place where we're seeing what's beyond that. We're seeing the divine image. And if you looked and you saw the divine image within every individual, you would have no problem inviting every individual over to your house to eat. You know, unfortunately, we all see people around the community who are in need. And for the most part, you know, maybe we'll give them a couple bucks here and there. But come to my house? I don't know about that. And he's saying on Pesach, that's really what we're saying. When we say Kol Dichvin Yeteh Ve'echol, that's really what we're saying. Everyone should come and eat. And why everyone? Because everyone is in the divine image. Not just me. Not just the, you know, me cleaned up in my suit and, you know, after showering and going to shul and looking the part. Everyone. And he says that's really something that we have to connect to. He goes on and also says that we need to be in that mindset for the duration of the Seder. That's where we have to be. The whole point of the Seder, again, the whole point of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, is being in this place of seeing the divine image. When we recognize the divine image in others, that is Yitzhak Mitzrayim. And he says, according to the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, and most poskim really, the main point of the Magid and of the Pesach Seder is the idea of v'higadeta lebincha, teaching our children. And that when we teach our children this idea that every individual is created in the divine image, that is when we'll really start to recognize in the future that the future is becoming more free. When people, next generation starts to emulate this idea. And for ourselves, the greatest freedom can really be recognizing that the future is secure in people who have this mindset, who have this mentality. So, as we said, the whole year is based on the Pesach Seder. So the climax of the Jewish year is the Yamim Noraim. And we can carry the same idea into the climax of the Seder, which is the Shulchan Aruch. As much as, you know, we'd like to think it's the Magid, now everyone's looking forward to the meal. And so that's really the climax of the Seder. We're all looking forward to it. We finally get to eat. And so there's one image which is mentioned a lot at the Yamim Noraim, which we also bring into the Pesach Seder, and it also has to do with being B'Tselem Elohim. Anyone want to venture to guess what that is? What's the image of Yamim Noraim that we also hear at the Seder? Melech. King, right? We're all royalty at the Seder. Everyone is royal at the Seder. How do we know? We sit and we recline. We are showing that we are free people. We are kings. We are in the divine image. Hashem is the king. And on Pesach, we say we too are royalty. And therefore, when we go through the Magid and not transition from seeing only at seeing other people in the divine image, but we start to recognize, wait, I'm also in the divine image, that is when we can act divine on a certain level, and we can treat ourselves as kings and as royalty. And finally, we go through the Seder, and we end off with the Nirtza. Nirtza comes from the root of Rotze, or Ratsui, something that is wanted or desired. And ultimately, what we're saying is that everything that happens at the Pesach Seder is what Hashem wants. This whole transition, this transition of coming from a place where we recognize our brokenness, and we transition into a place of recognizing we are in the divine image, and not only recognizing it, but acting it, living it, being it, and feasting as royalty, that is what is supposed to happen at the Pesach Seder. That is what was supposed to happen at Yetziat Mitzrayim. We came out, we came through physical redemption. Again, not the psychological redemption. At the Pesach Seder, we come through the psychological redemption, and we act appropriately. We come through and we recognize that we are royalty, we are in the divine image, we are whole. And the question is, if we will recognize that, you know, through our wholeness, where we truly belong, and we end up with Lashana Haba Yerushalayim, may we all be blessed to recognize that, you know, we are royalty and we belong as close to the palace as possible.
Good evening again. First, I want to mention that the program, the learning we're doing tonight, is being sponsored by the Reines family in memory of Moshe Ben Shlomo Reines, who's Neil's father, on the commemoration of the first of his first yurt site, which is coming up next week. Many ideas I want to share with you, I'll share with you right now, are based on an article I read by Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who is the senior scholar at the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. The commandment, the mitzvah that we have on the Seder night is to tell the story of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. We tell the story of the exodus of the Jewish people leaving Egypt. As Rabbi Churchiner mentioned before, where does that story begin? Where do we start telling the story of the Jewish people of the Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim? And the Gemara mentions that we begin with talking about the low state of the Jewish people, records to opinions, which again we incorporate both into the Haggadah, one being the fact that we descend from Terach, who was an idol worshiper, the other one being Avadim Hayinu, that we were slaves. But if you want to think and you want to tell the story of how the Jewish people perhaps got to Egypt and then how they left Egypt, you'd want to think that we would mention as part of the story the episode with Yosef and his brothers. Because how did the Jewish people get to Egypt in the first place? It was Yosef had this argument, this fight with his brothers sell him into slavery. Yosef ends up in Egypt, rises to power, etc. During the famine, brings over his family and resettles. They resettle in the land of Egypt and leave Eretz Yisrael. So you would think perhaps that we would mention this story in the Haggadah. But if you look in the Haggadah, we often like to mention that Moshe is only mentioned once and not even, you know, only as an aside in the Haggadah. But Yosef as well, if you look in the Haggadah, as far as I can tell, Yosef is not mentioned at all. Anyone know the closest reference we have to Yosef in the Haggadah?
The talking
Sorry? Oh, so we'll get there in a second. Hallel, where's he in? Oh, maybe his name comes up. But that's not Yosef. Okay. I think perhaps the closest reference, clear reference we have in the Haggadah is in Echad Miyodeya. Echad Asar Koch Vaya, the 11 stars in Yosef's dream. That's hardly the story with Yosef and his brothers. So even though he's not clearly mentioned, when you read through the Haggadah, you're not going to clearly see the story, you're not going to see the story of Yosef and his brothers at all in the Haggadah. There are, based on different commentators, different opinions, Yosef, the story of Yosef is, I would say, thrust into the Haggadah in several different places. I want to share three of them with you. The first one being the four cups of wine. Yisrael Meir mentioned earlier that, and I think that is perhaps the most famous, most well-known reason why we have four cups of wine on the Seder night, corresponding to, again, the four terms of redemption that God uses, describing how he's going to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. But there are other reasons given for why we have four cups of wine at the Seder. And another one of those reasons is, you know why we have four cups of wine at the Seder? Because when Yosef was in prison, he interpreted the dream of the butler and the baker. The butler's dream talked about him giving this cup of wine to Paro. And how many times does the word kos, how many times does the word cup appear in the description of the dream? Four times. So because it mentions the word kos, cup, four times in his dream, we drink four cups of wine on the Pesach night. Now, I think there's a much clearer connection in terms of the first reason I mentioned, in terms of the four terms of redemption and wine, because drinking wine is showing how we're free, we're redeemed. It seems to correspond very well to the, again, the four terms of redemption, describing how God's going to save the Jewish people. Not as clear, what is the connection, why do we care, between the four cups, four times the butler mentions the word kos, and the four cups of wine we drink the Seder night. So we did a similar program last night at Shari Tefillah, so I mentioned that, and somebody suggested, well, the butler also freed him. After the butler tells the dream, he goes out of jail. He also goes free, so maybe that's also a way to show freedom, perhaps. I thought that was an interesting answer. But that is just one place, this is one example of where we take Yosef and throw him into the story, seemingly where, I don't want to say he doesn't belong, but almost, you know, not in a clear manner. That's one. A second example, as we mentioned before, is the karpas. Why do we eat karpas on the Seder night? Karpas, people probably eat the potato, the celery, whatever your custom is. Why do we have the karpas the Seder night? What does the Gemara explain? Why do we have karpas Seder night? Sorry? Right, the answer to every question on Pesach, because we want the children to ask. And then once the children say, well, we're eating this because we were asking, now we're asking, and then you're stuck, what do we do now? Okay, so that's a separate issue. But the Gemara mentions the idea that we have karpas, we go on this like out of order, we want the children to ask. But there are other symbolisms given to the karpas as well. One being, when you look at the story of Yosef again, Yaakov gives Yosef the ketonet pasim. He gives him this fancy tunic, this fancy robe to wear. And how does Rashi describe this fancy robe? He uses the words, uses the word karpas specifically to describe this coat. Now, where does the word karpas appear? It appears once in all of Tanakh. It appears right in Megillat Esther. That is where the word karpas, when it talks about all the fancy grandeur at Ahasuerus' party, everything that's going on there. And the word, again, so the word karpas is being used to describe this ketonet hasim. And there are rabbis, I think Rabbeinu Manoah, who is a commentator on the Rambam, might be the first to make this connection, but many others make this connection as well, that the karpas represents the story, too, of Yosef and his brothers. Because when Yosef went to his brothers, and they, what is the first thing they do to him before they sell him? They strip him of his coat, and they dip it in blood. And what we have for the karpas, what the karpas represents, karpas corresponds to this ketonet that he wore. So that's the same thing. Why are we dipping the karpas into the most, assuming everyone here dips it into salt water? To represent the brothers dipping Yosef's coat into the blood. In fact, some people, I don't know anybody who has the custom now, and some people used to even dip the karpas into red wine to correspond to blood, to perhaps even more clearly show this connection between karpas and the story of Yosef and his brothers. So that is the second place where Yosef is being thrown into the Haggadah. And a third area, which I'd be surprised if anybody does this, is mentioned by Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, who was a rabbi in the 19th century. And he mentions a practice that before eating the afikoman, to take it, to wrap it up in a sack, sling it over your shoulder, and walk. And why are you doing that? to commemorate, that's because we want to remind ourselves of the Yishma Elim. You could say the tribe, the nomadic tribe that took Yosef and brought him into Egypt. And this is very much based on the Gemara, because the Gemara explains when they slaughtered the korb, the Pesach sacrifice, so everyone went to the Temple Mount, they sacrificed the korb of Pesach, they slaughtered it there, everyone had to bring it back home to eat it. So how did they bring it back home? They skinned the animal, threw the animal inside, into the skin, slung it over their shoulder, and walked. Why did they do that? And there too, one of the rabbis in the Gemara explains, they did it b'tayaut, which Rashi says, again, they're doing this to be like the Yishmaelim. Again, these nomadic tribes that were the ones who took Yosef and sold him into slavery in Egypt. So we do see, even though Yosef isn't clearly mentioned in the Haggadah, he is thrown in into and given symbolism, the story of Yosef and his brothers, in several different areas in the Seder night. And the question is why? Why are we trying to bring Yosef into the story? So I mentioned earlier, well, again, this was perhaps the beginning of the story. How did the Jewish people get down to Egypt in the first place? They got down because of Yosef and his brothers. But I think I think the message can be perhaps a bit deeper than that. And that is, what was the reason they came down? It's true, Yosef and his brothers. But that whole episode took place because of Sina, because of hatred, because of, you could say, disunity among the brothers not being unified. So that's going to be the reason why we went down. If that's going to be the beginning of the story, then we have to look, perhaps, use that and say, well, what's going to be the end of that story? How do we come out of Egypt? How are we free from Egypt? If we went down, perhaps, resulting as a fight, so we're going to have to come up as a result, perhaps, of coming together, of being a unified nation. And this is represented by the two dippings that we have on the Seder night. We mentioned the karpas as the first one, but as we mentioned in Manishana, we dip twice. And the first time we dip perhaps corresponds to Yosef, the story again with the brothers dipping Yosef's coat into the blood. And the second one corresponds to the Jewish people dipping the Ezov, the hyssop branch, hyssop tree, into the blood and smearing it onto their doorposts before leaving Egypt. And that represents the Jewish people leaving. And what are they dipping? It's not just one, you know, hyssop. It's an agudat Ezov. It's a bunch of hyssop. In order for the Jewish people to leave, they went down because of the dipping of Yosef's brother, the coat, into the blood in terms of the fighting. But how are they redeemed? Based on what? Based on the fact, aguda, coming together. They have to be one bunch. And by coming together, being one bunch, that will be a way, perhaps, to merit the freedom that we got from Egypt. So that might be one reason why we want to bring the story of Yosef. To recall, again, why we went down, perhaps through the fighting, and then ultimately the way we have to come out and be redeemed in terms of coming together. Another suggestion, perhaps, why I want to bring Yosef into the story is because the story of Yosef is another story of redemption, but a very different type of redemption than what we experienced in Yetziat Mitzrayim, leaving Egypt. Once Hashem decides to come and hit Mitzrayim with all the different plagues, you can very clearly see God's hand in the story. God comes in, plague after plague after plague. You know, there's no coincidences. The Jewish people are not being hit. The Egyptian people are being hit very hard. And throughout the plagues, then they get to the Yam Suf, crossing the sea, and there too God comes, splits the sea, allows the Jewish people to go through the dry land, and the Egyptians are drowned. It's very obvious. The redemption that takes place is very clearly God taking the Jewish people out of Egypt. When you look at the story of Yosef begins at the bottom, sold into slavery in Egypt, and rises all the way to the top to become the Mishneh Lemelech, the viceroy of Egypt. He's a different, perhaps, you know, he reaches the top, but it's a very different type of redemption. The story of Yosef is very much a roller coaster. He starts off right, you know, Yaakov's favorite son. He thinks perhaps he's being primed to take over the leadership role of the family. He's going up, And then all of a sudden his brothers send him right down. You know, they won't have it. They sell him into Egypt into slavery. He comes to Egypt. He goes to Potiphar's house. He works his way up. Becomes the most entrusted person in the whole house. There's nobody more important in Potiphar's house than Yosef. Works his way back up. Thinks, you know, perhaps he's on his way. And then the whole episode with Potiphar's wife, accusing Yosef of trying to have relations with her, right back down. Yosef is thrown right back down into jail. Gets to jail, once again, starts working his way up, becoming a trusted member, slave in jail, interprets the dreams of the butler, of the baker, requests of the butler, you know, when you go free, please tell Paro that I interpreted your dream, you know, get me out of this jail. He thinks perhaps he's on his way out. The butler forgets, you know, 2 more years until eventually he's taken out. Yosef, the story is up and down, up and down, up and down. And, but ultimately, Yosef does succeed. Ultimately, he is taken out and becomes, as mentioned before, the Mishneh LaMelech. And perhaps we want to recall the story of Yosef to recall another type of redemption, other types of redemption that we see through God. It's very easy to see God's hand in the story of the Jewish people leaving Egypt. It's not very easy to see God's hand in the story of Yosef. There are many parallels that are drawn between the story of Yosef and perhaps the Purim story. And one of them being, one of those parallels that are drawn is that in the whole book of Megillah Esther, God's name doesn't appear. When you look at the story of Yosef, I'm like Abraham, Isaac, and Yaakov. Yosef never directly talks to God. He doesn't have that direct connection with God. And God isn't as obvious. He's not showing himself. It's not as obvious for Yosef to be able to recognize God and the redemption that he's seen. But throughout the process, you see that Yosef constantly mentions God. When it comes to Pharaoh, it's God interpreting your dreams, it's God, it's God. Yosef is able to recognize, though he has his ups and downs, it's not that God's abandoned him. God is there working behind the scenes, working in a different way than, you know, obviously the Jewish people leaving Mitzrayim, but still there all along. And perhaps that's a message for us as well, bringing the story of Yosef into the Seder. That we want to remember Yosef to recognize that there are different types of redemption. Sometimes we experience redemption where God's mighty hand comes in, it takes, you know, wipes out the enemy and takes the Jewish people out. And sometimes he comes and it's not as obvious. There are ups and there are downs and there are ups and there are downs. But the goal, our goal is to recognize that ultimately it is God who is working behind the scenes, working through that redemption, and perhaps even nowadays to see the ups and downs the Jewish people experienced the last 100 years, to hope that here too, again, to recognize that it's God working behind the scenes, and ultimately that will bring us to the further redemption, the further geula, b'mhirah b'yameinu. Just one question I'll leave with you with. If I've convinced you enough that the story of Yosef is so important, the Haggadah night, then the question I'll leave you with is, then why is it not mentioned clearly in the Haggadah? You know, if it is so important, you have to balance, well, it wasn't, so maybe it is important, but at the same time, why, you know, why was it not put in? Why did Chazal not put that as part of the text? And the Haggadah itself, I'll leave that to you as a question to think about until now, until Pesach. Maybe you'll share it at your own Pesach Seder. That concludes, let's say, the formal part of the evening. But we know, Kol HaMar Be'Lasaper, B'Tiyam Yisrael Merizah Meshubach, the more we tell, the merrier. So we're not going to give any more oral teachings, but I just want to let everyone know that this week, in place of the regular Torah Torah that we put out, the current Kol members, and we've recruited many of the past Kol members as well, have written articles in what we're calling a Haggadah Companion on different aspects, different areas of the Haggadah that we placed in all these shuls. So we hope you'll be able to take there, continue learning from us, with us, relating to the Haggadah and other events in the future. Everyone have a great night.